going to introduce now what the Bible Project does with 2 Samuel. So we've read the first 8 chapters, basically, and we're going to do the 9th today. The 9th is like an interlude or a prelude, depending on your point of view, because starting in chapter 10, we get all the controversial stuff that happens with David's reign. We get David and Bathsheba, we get Absalom, we get the census. It's almost like it changes. And so I'm going to use this as an intro just to kind of reframe the first 8 chapters where we were. And the 9th chapter is a good thing, too. The 9th chapter, again, shows David at his best. It really does. And we'll see that today when he remembers his covenant with Jonathan. But then starting with the Ammonite War in chapter 10, it's a thing. So we're gonna talk about that because it's in the midst of that war that he commits adultery with Bathsheba. And so we can analyze that. So next week, we're going to do that really, really famous account found in 2 Samuel, starting in 10 through 12. We're also going to look at Psalm 51, one of the great penitential psalms in all of Scripture, which is his response to being rebuked by Nathan the prophet. So that's next week. That's a big one. So if you want one of the most famous passages or famous accounts, that's next week. After that one, then we'll have 2 weeks on Absalom, the first one being when he commits assault, basically, and then goes on the run, and then he leads a rebellion against David. And we get one of the famous grief prayers, "Oh, Absalom, Absalom, if it were me instead of you." It's one of those really famous, you know, kind of laments of a parent, even though Absalom was rebelling. A lot of you who are parents will recognize that when you have a teenager that's, you know, not necessarily following the faith or going wayward. A lot of you will commiserate with David there, is what I'll say. So we'll get to that also. So that's kind of our trajectory. So today we're going to do 2 Samuel 9, but we haven't looked at 2 Samuel yet through the Bible Project. And since I'm online, remember the caveats that I say with these folks is that, number one, they're not Lutheran. They're just kind of broadly evangelical. And they're also non-sacramental on things like baptism and communion. So with that caveat that it's a tool, it's not gospel, but they're really, really helpful. I would say their strongest suit, and I've said this before, is looking at the Bible as literature. That's their strongest thing. Like, how do we see the structure of this? Where is this headed? And they have really good graphics, you know, and so I use them for that, but with those caveats that they're not Lutheran and that sort of thing. If the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, Wisconsin Synod, or everybody else could do it at this quality, that would be awesome. It's, you know, kind of a need to interpret these in the light of Christ. And they are pretty Christocentric. I'll give them credit on that, but it would be nice if we, as a synod, had these sort of tools freely available, right? It would be awesome. But again, you have limited resources, right? Okay, so here's how they describe 2 Samuel. Here we go.
Book of 2 Samuel. Check out the video on 1 Samuel, where we were introduced to the book's 3 main characters, Samuel, Saul, and David, and then also to the book's literary design, which first introduced Samuel and then traced the rise and fall of King Saul in contrast to the rise of King David. 2 Samuel tells the story of David as Israel's king, and in 2 movements. There's a season of success and a blessing, followed by a huge moral failure and then its sad consequences. And then the book ends with this well-crafted conclusion that reflects back on the good and the bad in David's life, generating hope for a future king to come from his line. So 2 Samuel picks up after Saul's death, and David surprises everyone by composing this long poem where he laments the death of the very man who tried to murder him. And so once again, the author, he's presenting David's humility and compassion. He's a man who grieves the death even of his own enemies. After this, David experiences a season of success and God's blessing. All of the Israelite tribes, they come to David and then they ask him to unify all the tribes as their king. And so the first thing David does as king is to go to the city of Jerusalem. He conquers it and he establishes it as Israel's capital city, which he renames as Zion. And from there, David goes on and he wins many battles and expands Israel's territory. Now, after making Jerusalem the political capital of Israel, he wants to make it their religious capital as well. And so he has the Ark of the Covenant moved into the city. And then in 2 Samuel 7, he tells God, now that Israel has a permanent home, he thinks that God's presence should also get a permanent house. So he asks if he can build a temple for the God of Israel. But God says to David, thank you for that thought, but actually I'm going to build you a house, a dynasty. Now, 2 Samuel 7, this is a key chapter for understanding the storyline of the whole Bible, because God here makes a promise to David that from his royal line will come a future king who's going to build God's temple here on earth and set up an eternal kingdom. And it's this messianic promise to David that gets picked up and developed more in the book of Psalms and also in the books of the prophets. And it's this king that gets connected to God's promise to Abraham, the future messianic kingdom will be how God brings his blessing to all of the nations. And it's right here, in the midst of all this divine blessing, that things go horribly wrong. David makes a fatal mistake. Not fatal for him, but for a man named Uriah, one of David's prized soldiers. So from his rooftop, David sees Uriah's wife, Bathsheba, bathing. David finds her, he sleeps with her, gets her pregnant, and then he tries to cover the whole thing up by having Uriah assassinated and then marrying her. It's just horrible. So when David's confronted by the prophet Nathan about all of this, he immediately owns up to what he's done. He's broken, he repents, he asks God to forgive him, and God does forgive him, but God doesn't erase the consequences of David's decisions. And so as a result of this horrible choice, David's family, his kingdom, it all falls apart. And it makes this section a tragic story, much like Saul's downfall. So David's sons end up repeating his own mistakes, but in even more tragic ways. So Amnon sexually abuses his sister Tamar, and then their brother Absalom finds out about all of this and has Amnon assassinated. And then Absalom goes and he hatches the secret plan to oust his father David from power, and he launches this full-scale rebellion. And so for a second time, David is forced to flee from his own home and go hide in the wilderness, except this time he is not an innocent man. The rebellion ends when David's son is murdered, when it breaks David's heart. And so once again, he laments over the very man who tried to kill him. David's last days find him back on his throne, but as a broken man, he's wounded by the sad consequences of his sin. The book concludes with a well-crafted epilogue, with stories that are out of chronological order, but they have this really cool symmetrical literary design. So the outer pair of stories come from earlier in David's reign, and they compare the failures of Saul and then of David, and how each of them hurt other people through their bad decisions. The next inner pair of stories are about David and his band of mighty men who went about fighting the Philistines. And what's interesting is that both sections have a story of David's weakness in battle. So in contrast to the victorious David of chapters 1 through 9, here we see a vulnerable David who's dependent on others for help. The center of the epilogue has two poems that act like memoirs, and David reflects back on his life. And he remembers times when God graciously rescued him from danger. And he sees these as moments where God was faithful to his covenant promise to him and to his family. Both poems conclude by looking back onto the hope of God's promise of a future king who will build that eternal kingdom. Now, these poems and then God's promise also connect back to Hannah's poem that opened the book. And so these key passages from the beginning, now the middle, and the end of the book bring the book's themes all together. Despite Saul and David's evil, God remained at work, moving forward his redemptive purposes. And God opposed David and Saul's arrogance, but he exalted David when he humbled himself. And so the future hope of this book reaches far beyond David himself. It looks to the future, to the messianic king who will one day bring God's kingdom and blessing to all of the nations. And that's what the book of Samuel is all about.
There we go. So that's a really good kind of outline. So as we get deeper into 2 Samuel here, it's just a reminder, as you see that kind of screen on there, I left it on there on purpose, that 1 and 2 Samuel are the same book, right? It's divided into volumes. And so it, because the way our Bibles are set up now to make it more easy, and also because a huge scroll is a little, you know, unwieldy to try to carry around, you divide the book in half just so you have one scroll, right, for each. But it really is one continuous composition. And so seeing that on an outline is awesome, because you can see how those ending songs or poems connect to Hannah's song right at the beginning. Do you see how there's a structure there, right, in the writing? So it's neat to see that this is what they're good at. This is what the Bible Project's good at, is doing these sort of literary outlines so you can see the structures of the books. So if you don't catch that, that this is a really, really good way of doing that. And I commend it for that reason. Not theological reasons, but for literary reasons. It's an incredible book. I mean, an incredible resource that way. So now with that in mind, I want to zoom in. It's, you know, and I'll use my mouse on the screen there. Right towards the bottom, we have David saying, I'm going to build you a house, God, because you don't need to, you know, I'm living in this great house and you don't even have one. And God says, thanks, but no thanks. I'm going to build you a house. It's an amazing promise, really, as far as things go, because God's outside of time. He knows David's going to screw up, but he still makes the promise anyway, right? And that's an incredible thing. And so right before David and Bathsheba, there's this interlude And it's kind of a standalone chapter. It's what we're going to look at today. It's what your outlines are. If you grabbed an outline, if you didn't see them, they're on the piano. If you want to kind of look at that, the piano bench, my son was handing them out earlier. But if you joined us a little later, we're going to look at this passage in 2 Samuel 9. And so in our Concordia commentary series, this starts off the new section, and he calls it a prelude. David remembers his promise to Jonathan. It has no bullet points or anything else. It's just this standalone short chapter. There's no reference to this in Chronicles either. And so it's just kind of this odd little moment, but it's awesome because I think it gives us a picture of David at his best. And there's some messianic overtones in this as well. And that's on your outline as well. So let's look at this a little bit. So if you remember, David and Jonathan made a covenant together, right? Way back in 1 Samuel, even though Saul was trying to kill David, Saul's son, Jonathan, is the king Saul was supposed to be. Right. And so they are best friends. They, you know, it's really they're bros. Right. That's the best way to say it. We'd say that in modern culture. They hang out together. They care for each other. They're emotionally connected. They look at after each other's families and wives. You know, they're really what we would say in modern culture. They're bros. OK, they're brothers or brothers by another mother. If you've ever heard that phrase before, that's who they are. And so they make a covenant in this Old Testament culture. A covenant, right, is a sealed promise. And you are held to account by this. Usually it was done before God or done before a king or other witnesses. It's almost like a treaty or a legal agreement when you covenant together. And so that's why even today we still sometimes talk about the marriage covenant, right? And so it's a legal agreement that they're going to look out for each other's back. They're like allies. Instead of having two nations having a covenant where it's, if they go to war, I go to war. If somebody invades them, I'm going to go, you know, protect them. Dave and Jonathan have that covenant together where they have each other's back. So it's like a nation treaty only at the individual level between two families, if that makes sense. Okay. And so David's going to remember that in 2 Samuel 9 right here, and how Jonathan's gone and Saul's gone, even though Saul tried to kill him, you saw that in the outline there, David doesn't forget his promise to Jonathan. He's faithful in his remembrance. It's pretty neat. And again, there's going to be a messianic overtone to this that I hope you pick up on. And I'll highlight that when we get there. So look at this text with me here. If you have your Bible in front of you, I'm in the ESV this time. This is 2 Samuel 9. I have it on your screen as well. But if you want it in front of your text, that's up to you. And David said, "Is there still anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" Now there was a servant in the house of Saul whose name was Ziba, and they called him to David. And the king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" And he said, "I am your servant." And the king said, "Is there not still someone of the house of Saul that I may show the kindness of God to him?" Notice that David isn't saying that this is my kindness. I'm trying to be godly and try to represent God's mercy and graciousness to Saul's family, even though they probably don't deserve it, right? Okay. Ziba said to the king, "There is still a son of Jonathan. He is crippled in his feet." The king said to him, "Where is he?" And Ziba said to the king, "He is in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, at Lo Debar." Then King David sent and brought him from the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, at Lo Debar. And Mephibosheth, this one's a fun one, Mephibosheth, there we go, Mephibosheth. I'll say that one wrong five times, just to warn you, okay? But Mephibosheth, there we go, Mephibosheth, okay? The son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David and fell on his face and paid homage. This is very common all the way up through the Middle Ages that when you are in the presence of the king, you prostrate yourself, right? You're like nose to the, you go all the way down, you humiliate yourself. Oddly, the one place that this has still continued in like say Judeo-Christian circles is when a bishop is consecrated in the Roman Catholic Church. They actually go face down and they like kind of make a cross to show that they're basically dying to Christ and their face is on the ground. I mean, they are literally nose to the ground. Some priests will do this as well. And then they're brought up. And so they humble themselves, making the sign of the cross. And so that prostration, only in this case, it's before the representative of Christ, like the Pope or somebody, or it's just the cross or the crucifix. And so in the Roman Catholic Church, this symbolism still kind of exists. We don't do that in our tradition anymore. When Luther took his vows as a monk, he did this. He prostrated himself. If you've seen the Luther movie from 2003, when he's in front of, I think, the archbishop, he's down like that too. And so that's what's happening here because David not only is the king politically, he's God's representative. Okay. And that's why David even says that I'm going to do this and show the mercy of God to this family. Right. And so David understands this. And so Mephibosheth does this out of humility, but also probably out of fear because it's not like he's ignorant of his family's history, right? And he's crippled too. And so he's not sound of body. OK, Okay. All right, so he fell on his face. That's verse 6 here. I'll put the mouse on here. You go, paid homage. And David said, Mephibosheth. And he answered, Behold, I am your servant. And David said to him, Do not fear, for I will show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. And I will restore to you all the land of Saul your father, and you shall eat at my table always. And he paid homage and said, What is your servant that you should show regard for a dead dog such as I? It's a weird thing to try to translate into English. I read the study notes out of this. And you may know this, in Arab cultures and in Israeli cultures and other cultures as well, dogs are an unclean animal because they eat dead stuff. And so dead stuff, you don't associate with dead stuff. So they, because they're in contact, they're considered kind of, they're almost like carrion type animals, right? They eat, they're scavengers. And so they were not clean. Most people did not have pet dogs. Okay. If you had pet dogs, it was more like they were out in the fields just guarding you or protecting things. And so they were considered an unclean animal. So calling somebody a dog is definitely an insult in this culture. And so this is abject humility. I am an unclean, unworthy, I should be cast outside of the camp type person. So Mephibosheth is like, I have nothing that I can contribute to the situation. So he's abject humility. Then the king called Ziba. This Ziba figure we think is probably kind of like the executor of Saul's estate. He's running the household, but he's not actually the heir to the estate. He's just kind of keeping things going, because if you remember, when we find Saul in 1 Samuel, he's watching over flocks and looking for sheep. And so that was wealth back then. You had sheep, you had animals, you had flocks and herds. You were wealthy. That means you're rich. If you look at the book of Job, you look at Abraham. If you have flocks and herds surrounding you, you're rich. It's interesting now because in our culture, that actually means you're poor. Isn't that weird how that's kind of shifted in culture, because we're more about capital and business and, you know, other sorts of wealth. But here, having flocks and herds was wealth. And so Ziba's managing the family of Saul's estate is the idea. So he's some sort of executor or family servant. So the king calls Ziba, Saul's servant, and says to him, All that belonged to Saul and to all his house I have given to your master's grandson. And you and your sons and your servants shall till the land for him and shall bring in the produce that your master's grandson may have bread to eat. But Mephibosheth, your master's grandson, shall always eat at my table. Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. Again, this is probably in a culture where sometimes, you know, God's design of monogamy wasn't always obeyed, right? And so that's probably why he has that many, although it's not impossible. For a woman to have that many children, of course. Then Ziba said to the king, according to all that my lord the king commands, his servant, so will your servant do. So Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. And Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah. And all who lived in Ziba's house became Mephibosheth's servants. So Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he ate always at the king's table. Now he was lame in both his feet. Notice that he emphasizes his lameness twice. Okay, so here's the connection. You might have this printed for you. This is a really awesome way of looking how David shows himself to, at least temporarily, be a messianic king. And I printed this for you from this commentary. I summed it up a little bit. So if what I read is not identical to that handout, that's why, I just to make it easier to kind of see in print form. But this is from the Steinman commentary on 2 Samuel. So it's worth looking at. This is what he says. He says, this short account of David's demonstration of Yahweh's grace to Mephibosheth illustrates David's character as a faithful follower of God. It shows David fulfilling his vow to Jonathan, which was sworn in Yahweh's name, and so could be called a covenant of Yahweh and Yahweh's oath. So you're swearing a covenant by a God who does not change. Yahweh is the I am that I am, right? So if you swear by the I am and how God always fulfills his promises, that means you are obligated as his servant to always fulfill your promises, because it's a reflection on Yahweh's character. That's why breaking an oath is so serious in this culture, especially an oath sworn in the Lord's name, because by doing it, you're actually insulting God, because it's like saying, well, I'm swearing by the unchanging God, and so now I'm going to break this covenant. Does that mean God can do that too? Or that that's God's character to break his covenants. Do you see the symbolism of that? That's why it's so rich when they make these covenants, and why they took them very seriously. And also why in the Old Testament, it's like God says, don't do this very much, or try not to do this. But if you do this, this is what you do. And then the New Testament, Jesus says, don't even do this at all. Because if you fail, right, what does this mean? And so he just says, don't swear on God or on creation or on your family or whatever. Just let your yes be yes and your no be no, right? Jesus kind of improves on this and adds to it in that sense. Okay, anyways, although Jonathan, who had died a decade earlier, David neither overlooked nor forgot his obligation to both Jonathan and Yahweh to keep his pledge. As such, David serves as an example to Christians of faithful dealings with one's neighbor and fidelity to the true God, who has revealed his steadfast love for all, even the most disadvantaged, in Jesus Christ. David welcomed a disabled man to his royal table. The son of David came to heal the lame and welcome all to the feast at the royal banquet of God. You catch this connection here? So here's David, welcomes this lame dude and says, you're going to sit at the king's table. Every single human being that humbles himself and in faith comes to Christ can eat at the king's table. So this is a messianic foreshadowing of what Christ does for all of us, because we are lame spiritually. We are broken spiritually. We have damage. We are damaged goods. We don't deserve to eat at the king's table, right? I mean, what I try to tell my high school students all the time, you know, those little private secret sins that you have that you think nobody else knows about them, do you think God knows about them? You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, those secret things that you dream about, those things, because that's what we like to do as Americans. So when we apply this is my application a little bit here. So forgive me a little bit. I'm being kind of devotional, but that's what I want to do here. We as Americans are very private and very individualized. And so especially in a place like East Idaho, we learn this kind of, well, you just leave me alone and I'll leave you alone. As long as you don't hurt anybody else, it's okay. As long as it's almost kind of a libertarian mindset. It's about the individual, right? Individual rights. And so it really is. It's really kind of a new, I don't know if honor code is the right word, but it kind of is kind of an honor code where it's, you can pretty much do whatever you want as long as you don't hurt anybody else. So you have your rights and your borders. I have my rights and my borders. And what you do in your private life, I don't care. Right? As long as it doesn't impact mine or impact my kids or something. Now, of course, there's a limit to this when we see things like, what should we do for public policy? Right? So there is a limit on some of these things. But the mindset, the day-to-day living, that's how we think. And so, but if we're honest with ourselves, and that's why we have confession, as Pastor Dinger said today, if we're honest with ourselves, we know that we bring nothing. We're corrupt. We're broken. We're Mephibosheth. When we approach the king of the universe, right? Who am I? What is your servant? I'm nothing, right? And yet God still says, you get the kingdom with me and you get to eat at my table. And that's totally undeserved, or as we say in our catechism, without any merit or worthiness on my part. That's why, our small catechism, and the more I do this, the more awesome that really is to me. I was brought into the Lutheran tradition via the like bigger doctrinal things, like the Augsburg Confession, the Formula of Concord, which are awesome. And I still know those better than the small catechism. I'm a weird Lutheran because I know our bigger documents better than the one everybody learns. Do you see what I'm saying? Because I came in from like a master's systematic theology level. So I came in that way. I didn't grow up memorizing the catechism. My son has to do it, but I didn't have to do that because I was raised in a different tradition. He's doing it right now, actually. It's kind of fun. So, and by teaching it to him, it's helping me revisit it, which is awesome because I came in here reading the Augsburg Confession. I came in here reading the Formula of Concord or Luther's large catechism, but the small catechism is a treasure for things like that, right? And you see it here without any merit or worthiness in my part, right? I cannot by my own reason or strength come to my Lord Jesus or believe in him, right? But the Holy Spirit creates that faith in me. And so that's I paraphrase that a little bit, but that's the point, right? That's why we need to teach that to ourselves over and over and over again and why it's a treasure. At National Convention, sorry, this is just a little moment. At National Convention, the Synod President told this story about this farmer in Arkansas. And the Synod President's from the Midwest. He's like South Dakota native, but he was in Missouri and other places. But this farmer in Arkansas had this real thick, like rural kind of like Southern yokel accent, you know? And he's like, hey, Pat, he's like, hey, President Harrison. And he like had this thing going. He's like, yeah, what's that? You know, I'll just say Farmer John, you know, Farmer John, what do you think that you should do to give young people? These young people need help. And Harrison's like, yeah, I agree with that. And he's like, so you know what I do? I take my truck after school and I give them a catechism. and he's like, okay. And this farmer's like, yeah, I went on the sale at, what do you guys call it? That Monday cyber thing. And he's like, that Monday cyber thing, I bought like a box of them. And so when they come out of school, I give them a catechism. And he told this story. And he was like, and so it was funny, the Synod President's up and the convention's kind of laughing at this point. He's like, so maybe that's our solution. Go into the schools and give them a catechism. You know, it was kind of funny. Everybody's laughing. And we actually did catechism study at National Convention. So we had a leader who actually had, so they gave out, you know, hundreds of catechisms. And during the middle of convention, we went through this. as a convention. Hey, what do we believe, teach, and confess? Remind ourselves. Why are we here? There's actually a neat touch. It's new. It was new this last convention. It was a neat touch that we can always be taught. We don't know everything. We always need to revisit and talk about the scriptures and what we believe. And it was kind of a neat moment there. And so that's just my little plug for you. If you don't have that, if you don't have one, by the way, ask Pastor, he'll get you one. Okay. He will help you get one. And they're free online. You can go to bookofconcord.org and other places. There's apps. There's an app too. And so there's many things that you can do for that. So anyways, this is an awesome passage connecting us to Christ. So I'm keeping you there. So I want to show this. So in your, I think I gave you a few of those references in the outline. So I'm going to show you and this is also why having cross references and having things like Bible Gateway and other tools are so awesome in our modern day. This is a good use of technology. I want to look at the reference that Steinman gives to you. So I'm going to do the one in Matthew 11, just to show you this connection and how it's made true in Christ. Okay, now when Jesus, this is Matthew 11, when Jesus had finished instructing his 12 disciples, he went on from there to teach and preach in their cities. Does that sound like the Mark passage today from scripture, by the way? Like this is our gospel reading in Mark. It's very similar to this. Okay, so and Jesus heals and casts out demons and that also. So you can make the connection to today's church gospel reading. That would be totally legitimate also. Now, when John heard in prison, that's John the Baptist, about the deeds of Christ, he sent word by his disciples and said to him, "Are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another?" That's an amazing statement there. John baptized Jesus and he's still struggling, right? And Jesus answered him, "Go and tell John what you hear and see. The blind receive their sight and the lame walk. Lepers are cleansed and the deaf hear, and the dead are raised up, and the poor have good news preached to them, and blessed is the one who is not offended by me." And so you see this fulfillment here in Matthew. The other passage that he has, there's Matthew 15. So let's look at that really quick. Again, making these Old and New Testament connections with the Old Testament as the cradle of Christ is an awesome thing. So Matthew 15, going further down, starting in verse 29, Jesus went on from there and walked beside the Sea of Galilee. Again, our Mark gospel is this, okay? And he went up on the mountain and sat down there. And great crowds came to him, bringing them the lame, the blind, the crippled, there you go, the mute, and many others. And they put them at his feet, and he healed them, so that the crowd wondered when they saw the mute speaking, the crippled healthy, the lame walking, and the blind seeing. And they glorified the God of Israel. So this, I mean, if when you start reading this in light of 2 Samuel, it becomes, for lack of a better term, so obvious. You have to like willfully try to reject that or try to explain it away to reject these connections. And Matthew in particular was, we think when he wrote his gospel, he was writing to Jews. Because Matthew of all four gospels quotes the Old Testament the most and references prophecy the most. And so reading 2 Samuel with Matthew is pretty meaningful. Because that he really is emphasizing how Christ fulfills the messianic promise to David. That's the reason the Davidic line Matthew's gospel starts off with a genealogy. There's a reason for that, because you can see that they're in the house and lineage of David. Okay, so that's kind of that. So with the last 10, 15 minutes, I want to start and do a little prelude with you of what we're going to see next week. But any comments on this just really small chapter, this interlude? Very rich. Just 13 verses, but there's more in it than you would think. Okay, so what I want to do, and you have this on the back of your handout here, Alec, let me just borrow yours really quick. I'll give it back to you. Okay, on the back of your handout, you have the Ammonite War. You can see the scripture references up here. So 2 Samuel 10 through 12 and 1 Chronicles 19 through 20. This is our next topic starting next week. But I want to preview this because I don't want to take time doing like historical stuff with you. I want to do mostly the theology of this. I want to kind of point this map out because it's really, really clear. And you see Ammon to the southeast, down close to the Dead Sea. And so biblical Ammon has been confirmed in biblical archaeology, and I want to review who these folks are. So we read about, especially to the southeast of Israel, we see Ammon, we see Moab, right? We see Edom, and these terms. I've mentioned this before, but now I really want to look at where they are. So if you do this, I recommend this. This is a free article. If you want to know more about this, if you go to biblical archaeology and search Ammon, and who was Ammon, or who was the tribe of Ammon? I spelled that wrong, right? If you go down to this, who were the Ammonites, Moabites, and Edomites? So this is from the Biblical Archaeology Society. If you want to know who they are, this is a really kind of good look at this. This came out in 2023 in July. So this is like the updated state on this. And now biblical archaeology is not necessarily Christian. It's not necessarily even biblically friendly, although it's biblical archaeology. It's kind of written from kind of a semi-skeptical perspective because they're quote unquote scientific in what they do, but it does confirm some things and helps us know who these folks are. So it says ancient Israel's neighbors each east of the Jordan. So if you want to look that up or Google that for yourself, it's pretty obvious what this is. But Bible History Daily, who are they? And it'll also talk about like what we know about their religion and other things. So I'm not going to read this whole thing, but I want to point some stuff out. So who are the Ammonites, the Moabites, and the Edomites in the Bible? When the kingdoms of Israel and Judah controlled the land of Canaan, the kingdoms of Ammon, Moab, and Edom ruled east of the Jordan. Okay, and you can see this in this map. I'm going to show that and blow that up for you. So Edom, Moab, and Ammon. And Ammon's on the map that I printed for you there also. Okay, because that's going to be the Ammonite War. And that's where the stuff with Bathsheba is going to take place. So you can see that there. But there's Ammon. So the bottom of your map is where I'm moving my mouse there. Then Moab's right below that. And Edom's all the way down here in the desert. Okay, so just to kind of give you geographically oriented here on what's happening in this passage. Okay, who are the Ammonites? In the Bible, they are descended as, they are described as being descendants of Ben-Ami, who was the son of Lot, Abraham's nephew, and of Lot's younger daughter. It's kind of a gross part of scripture, to be honest. And which is another reason why I think the scriptures are true, because it doesn't shrink from embarrassing facts. It's called the principle of embarrassment. If you want to make your heroes look good, you don't include bad stuff. The Bible doesn't shrink away from the bad stuff, right? And so that actually adds, from a historical perspective, some credibility to it. Because if you merit embarrassing material about your heroes or your ancestors, it means you're probably telling the truth. You following? This is why we know this is probably true, okay? The capital of the Iron Age kingdom of Ammon was Rabbah, which is located at modern-day Amman, Jordan. The name Amman, Jordan is named after the Ammonites. So it's, in other words, even just in the place name, this is where they are. So the modern country of Jordan is called Amman or Ammon. It's the Ammonites, okay? Here we go, which was located, Burnett describes, it's an archaeologist, the boundaries of Ammon. The Ammonite heartland comprised the north central Transjordan plateau encircled by the upper Jabbok. The Jabbok is a river within a 12 and a half mile radius of its capital at the headwaters of the Jabbok. The Ammonites' primary deity was the god Milcom. Depictions of Milcom have been uncovered through archaeological excavations, as have representations of the Ammonite kings, such as the monumental statue uncovered in 2010. Here's the monumental statue, if you want to kind of see that. It's huge, several feet tall, okay? And so we know, again, in archaeology, and this is what's awesome is, from an outside perspective, it's confirming the biblical narrative. So you know that the scriptures aren't just making up, you know, it's not like Star Wars and saying like, you know, that's the Solistian race or something, or Star Trek, you know, he's a Klingon, okay? They're not like making up races or something or making up peoples and places. This isn't fantasy. This is real people and real places, and archaeology is confirming this. So even outside the scriptures, we have evidence of these groups. So that's why it's key for us that way, okay? So that's the Ammonites, and that's who we're going to run into. Okay, then we have the Moabites, who we encountered last week. In the Bible, the Moabites are said to have descended from Moab, the other son of Lot and his oldest daughter. The kingdom of Moab stretched north and south of the Arnon River with its capital at Dibon. The Moabites worshiped the god Shamash, who may be depicted in the Beulah Steel. The most famous Moabite king from the archaeological record is the Misha, and Misha describes Israel. This is an outside, we've seen this before, now you can see it in a different context. This mentions Israel. So you don't even have to have the Bible, and the house of David and the nation of Israel are mentioned outside of the Bible. This is, again, further evidence that what we're reading is confirming the archaeological record. Our faith is not based in archaeology, but it's pretty neat. We don't have to, you know, we don't have to rest on what we hope to be true here. Okay. And then the Edomites, the last group in the Bible, the Edomites are the descendants of Esau, Jacob's twin and Isaac's oldest son, and they are more in the desert in the southeast. And you can see the Edomite goddess that they're wearing here, a three-horned headdress from the side of Israel. Now, a couple of comments I want to make about this that are to help you contextualize what's going on here. By the way, over here in where Gaza is, now, you know, always in the news, that's the Philistines. Okay, that's where the Philistines are. Now, with that in mind, here's a few things that I want to point out. The reason these nations are still here is because God made that promise to Abraham. And since God made that promise to Abraham, God allows the nation of Lot's two sons and their descendants, the Ammonites and the Moabites, to keep that land for Abraham's sake, even though they're pagans. So it's an act of mercy from God. And so if you read the conquest of Canaan, when you look at, like, say, the book of Joshua or the book of Deuteronomy, the reason the Moabites are there and God says, don't worry about them, I've promised that, that's why they're still present here. But the Ammonites in the north are a pain in the neck to Israel and have been the entire time. And so God allows this war against the Ammonites to take place. Remember, though, that one of David's descendants, right, is going to marry a Moabitess, Ruth. Actually, no, wait, one of his ancestors, sorry, the other way around. One of David's ancestors is Ruth, right? So Obed, his great-great-grandpa or grandpa, Obed is in that line because he's the son of Boaz and Ruth. So anyway, so that's the connection there. So again, God allows this to go, and it ends up being in David's own lineage. So that's something to keep in mind going forward, and which means in the line of Christ, right? So this is what's going to set this up. And I'm just, again, I'm not trying to bore you or anything. I'm just trying to show you that this connects. Now, this is where Pastor Dinger's class and my class will kind of come together a little bit. Because if you look at the nation of Israel and you look at these nations, Ammon, Moab, Edom, if you go back to this article and click on this, right? And this is from its other thing. What it'll say at the end, you go all the way to the bottom. Let's see. Was there a cultural reason? No, it's up here. I think it was Ammon where they went. Yeah. So in this, and there's a Roman theater in downtown Ammon and these sort of places. If you read both of these articles, you'll come to this conclusion. They were absorbed, all three of these cultures, the Edomites, the Ammonites, and the Moabites, into Arab culture. And so the Arabs and what we would now call the modern Palestinians are perhaps, also the Philistines, are perhaps, again, we can't prove this with 100% doubt, progenitors of what modern people call the Arab peoples or even the Palestinian peoples. And so they're not Israelites. They're not people that were actually in the land of Canaan at this time. They're on the fringes on the east side of the Dead Sea, right? And they all blend in with the modern Arab cultures, the Ishmaelites, the Edomites, and all of them. They all come together and become the modern Arab peoples. And so this gives you some context to some of the stuff that's going on in the Middle East right now, to be honest. That's how ancient some of this is and how ancient some of this adversarial relationship is. This is not new. Now, the rise of Islam changes it and gives it a different dynamic, but this conflict has been going on at least since 1000 BC. Yeah.
I thought, weren't a couple of the tribes over there, Reuben and Gad or something, I thought, weren't they in the same area or are those east?
So these are east of the Dead Sea. There's the Jordan River, right? And so stuff east of the Jordan River isn't really populated by Israel. Now, David and Solomon bring it into subjugation, but that wasn't part of the original inheritance. So you've got Judah and then down, and I can show you a map of that. We have time, I can show you a map of that. Benjamin and Judah are down here. And then the other 10 tribes are in the north. North, they're way up, like off this map.
I thought there were a couple tribes.
On the very far east fringe. Yes, you're correct about, like, on the bank of the Jordan River. Yes. So if you want to see this 12 tribes, map, we'll pull it up for everybody's sake here. This is what's handful. Yeah, like Manasseh, Gad, and Reuben. Yeah, if you look. I'll just pull this up. This is the wiki. And again, wikis can be inaccurate, but we'll do it for now for the sake of speed. Okay, there you go. Wow, that's bigger than I thought. Yeah, Alex celebrating. That's a huge map. So that's kind of handy. But if you could kind of see that, let's see if I can find a smaller one. There we go. And then I can zoom in. There we go. So this is what you're talking about right here. Yeah. See it? So see where Ammon is? Because, yeah, they're on the bank. So there's Ammon. There's Moab. There's Edom. Now, Moab and Edom, Israel's never down there, right? But you're right that Ammon is closer up here. And so they're Gad. And the reason is the closer you are to the river, the more fertile it is. Right. So you're going to publish both. You'd be on both banks of the river. OK, by the way, in modern times, when you hear the quote unquote, the West Bank, that's the West Bank of the Jordan. That's the West Bank. OK, if you see that in the news and stuff like that. And there's some stuff over here, too. But that's why it's called that. What people of Israel call it are Judea and Samaria. Okay, as far as that goes, because it goes all the way up to it goes all the way up to the Sea of Galilee, which is which is that thing right up there, is Galilee. Okay, so there you go. So you're right, Kevin, that they're there, but Ammon's further over and Moab's further there, and most of them, as you see here, just keep going all the way up north, right, as far as that goes, to give you some context. So no, good clarification. I appreciate that. So this is what we're starting next week. So when we get to David and Bathsheba, he's making war with the Ammonites right here. But he's in his palace in Jerusalem, which is way down here across the river, which means he's letting other people do his fighting for him at this point. And so that's kind of part of the problem here. And you're gonna see that next week as we move forward. All right. Any comments or questions before we break? Yes, go ahead.
Bible study a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
The pastor that says, and it was a time when kings go forth to war,
mm-hmm.
and David stayed home.
Yep.
And he was, should have been there, because he wasn't there, he was where he shouldn't be.
Right.
And things happened because he was not at the time when kings go forth to war.
Yep. Yeah, yeah. They, you were supposed to lead your. In fact, that's how you proved your kingliness. Now, you may not be fighting on the front lines, but you were present because you're helping direct strategy. You're inspiring your men. You're directing your commanders. I mean, you're still present. You're like a general, really. Okay. And even as late as like, see, look at ancient Rome. If you've now, it's not an accurate part of history, but this part is. If you watch the original movie Gladiator, the premise of that is Marcus Aurelius is in his later years. He's an old, frail man, and yet he's still on campaign. He's not in Rome. He's on the front lines. Now, he's in the royal tent. He's not out there fighting with his sword, but he's on the front lines guiding his generals. And so, yes, David is screwing up just by not being present. That it was his duty to be present, and he's not. So that shows you, and like you said, when you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing, sometimes bad things can happen. Or when you have, you've ever heard the phrase, idle hands make the devil's playthings. David has idle hands. And that's going to lead to that sin. So that's a good preface for what we're going to do next week as far as things go. And also what Pastor Dinger said today, that the Bible is very clear about the realities of the spiritual world, angels and demons. This is a good thought here, right? Behind some of these things, he's like, I'm not paranoid. I don't think there's a devil behind every tree. That's not us. Okay. We're not that. However, when you look at the macro view of the world and you look at the confusion that exists in culture, don't you think there's something going on there spiritually? Maybe. Mm-hmm. Right. And so it's okay to say that. I wrote a note to my son in the bulletin about that, right? That some of these trends that we see might have demonic origins. And so that's actually one of my most favorite novels of all time is Dostoevsky's Demons, or sometimes it's called The Possessed. If you know Dostoevsky, he wrote Crime and Punishment, Brothers K, Karamazov, Notes from the Underground. Awesome author. Love Dostoevsky. Very Christian. He had his own struggles in his life. The name of that book, Demons, is not all about demon possession. It's about bad ideas. And this revolutionary, it's based on a true story. And this revolutionary tries to like overturn this town to like create this new like anarchist utopia. And so there's a murder and there's this great conspiracy and they try to basically take over this town. And yet it's called Demons. Do you see what he's saying?
Yes.
That behind these ideologies that are destroying society are spiritual forces, but you read it and you don't even get the Christian message, but it's from a Christian world. It's awesome. It's heavy. It's Russian literature. So you got to like, you need like the Playmobil. I mean, the playbill on the front. Okay. Who's who? What's their nicknames? You know, it takes the thing. You need a good translation. But one of my favorite novels of all time that illustrates that is called Demons. And it's almost prophetic. Yeah. I have a copy at home. Yeah. Yeah. A cushions and an aspirin. Yeah, you gotta make yourself comfortable, right? It's true. It's true. So yeah, I do have it. If you want to look at that sometime, it's a hard read. It's a hard read, but it's a good read. You know, some of the good things are hard. All right, we got to close. I'm starting to get close to running over. May the Lord bless us and keep us. The Lord make his face shine upon us and be gracious unto us. The Lord lift up his countenance upon us and give us peace. Amen.
If you have any questions or comments, email them to podcast@gracepocatello.org. And make sure to subscribe to our channel to stay up to date on sermons and classes at Grace Lutheran Church in Pocatello, Idaho. This podcast is designed so that you can take grace with you anywhere you go.